This is the podcast for Physics 2710. The date is the 16th of January, 2007. We're basically done with Chapter 1 unless you have questions, so this is your chance. Questions on blackbody radiation, Michelson-Morley experiment, that's actually kind of addressed also in Chapter 2, but we talked about it a little bit in Chapter 1 as part of the outstanding issues, electrodynamics and the electromagnetic medium. Ultraviolet catastrophe was the ultraviolet curves that didn't bend down like they were supposed to until we put in the H that made the experiment match the theory. Any questions about classical physics or the state of physics in 1895, what the issues were, before we jump into relativity? Hearing and seeing none, we will move on. Section 2 of Chapter 2 is about the Michelson-Morley experiment. And we watched a little bit of the mechanical universe last time to get up to speed on that particular experiment. It goes down in history as one of the most famous physics experiments of all, and especially the most famous negative experiment, meaning that it came back not the way we expected it to do. The construction is detailed a little bit on page 25 in figure 2.4, the caption. It talks about the fact that they floated it on mercury, as I mentioned the other day, to isolate it from the gistling and jostling of people walking by. So it was a very sensitive experiment, and they talk about how sensitive it needed to be in some of those derivations there. But I won't spend a lot more time on that unless you have questions, because we did actually address that last time and with the video. So any questions about that section of Chapter 2? Yes,
Jacob. On the next page, it's in the same section, but it talks about the stellar aberration.
Stellar aberration.
And I guess it was there was another experiment done that showed there was no ether, but I wasn't understanding how that worked out. I don't know.
Stellar aberration is an interesting thing that you wouldn't expect to be able to observe, because it's kind of a tiny effect, but they can observe it, and they noticed it before they figured out the explanation for it. If the Earth kind of dragged the ether along with it, and as the light comes down through the ether, it comes into your telescope tube, it should all be lined up perfectly, and the ether won't be like the moving wind or whatever in the next example, alternate way of looking at things. We'll talk about the analogy here of the sitting in the car in the rainstorm. The raindrops appear to fall vertically when the car is at rest, but appear to be slanted when the car is moving forward. You're looking at the side window here, and the drizzles appear to be slanted this way if you're moving forward, because as they go down, the car's moving forward. You would expect to see the same thing if... you would not expect to see the same thing if the ether moves along with you. That would be like the rain moving along with you. But since the rain's falling straight down and you're moving through it, so if the ether is dragged along, you do not expect to see that effect. But since we do see the effect, that means that the ether isn't being dragged along with us and isn't out there. It's kind of a piece of evidence against the existence of the ether. It would mean that you'd have to point your telescope in a slightly different angle, just like you'd have to point your view along the rainy windshield at slightly an angle to get the straight line view of the rain. You'd have to do that with starlight too. And you say, man, how much could that be if light's moving so fast and it's only got to go through a telescope tube that long? How much can it have to be off? But they can measure that kind of stuff, and they did see this effect of stellar aberration. So it's kind of an interesting deal. It's not a huge deal. I don't know if it played into Einstein's deliberations or not at all, but I don't know. Does that help explain what they're talking about there?
Makes a lot more sense. Thanks.
Well, just to clarify, you're just talking about the light coming into the telescope?
Straight down the tube, yes.
Okay, but if everything is moving through the ether, as they thought, why would moving the telescope change the view? I'm trying to ask this, but why would changing the telescope make it so that you can see the star? If everything is being dragged along,
if the ether were dragged along, we wouldn't have to move the telescope to see the star. But because we do have to move the telescope at a slightly different angle to see the star, that means that the ether is not being dragged along. So it's probably not even there.
Okay, so this is something that we do have to do when we observe the stars?
Yes.
So we have to change our view of the telescope?
We have to incline the telescope slightly to see the stars at an angle that they really shouldn't be at because of the movement of the Earth.
I didn't even know that.
Well, it's a little known fact. I'll try and find you some more information on stellar aberration. It's not a huge deal, but it's kind of an interesting little sideshow. It's kind of fun.
Yeah, I don't understand that either, because, if you see a star, you're seeing the light at your eye. That didn't make sense to me. How come you don't just point it out the light you see coming, because it's already there at that angle?
You do point it at the light you see coming, but it's coming from a different direction than where you know the star really is supposed to be from other measurements because of the Earth's motion. This is a cyclical thing throughout the year, and so 6 months later you have to point it slightly the other way to see the star as you're moving around the orbit around the sun is going in the opposite direction.
That part sort of makes sense to me. I guess I'm kind of with Deb. It's just I don't know how you'd ever notice that. If you're standing outside the solar system and looking at stars and whatever, you can see that that's how, I guess, it would work. That sort of makes sense. But whoever saw it, I don't understand how you actually see that 20 seconds of arc.
41 seconds of arc. It's a little circular motion that has a periodic, it's periodic with a period of 1 year. That means that you have to point your telescope at different times of the year in a 41-second degree circle to catch the light that's coming down the tube at that time as you go around the sun in your earthly orbit. So you notice that the star undergoes a little circular motion through the sky that you have to count for with the pointing of your telescope that's 41 seconds of arc. Now, if this isn't making a whole lot of sense, I'll try to find a better explanation or some more information that will help clear this up and put it on the web page, or send it to you by email, or I'll bring something next time, I don't know. It's, like I say, it's not a big deal. I don't want you to stress on this issue. It's not a major deal, but as long as you're interested and curious, I will do my best to try to answer the questions. So it sounds like you're not totally satisfied with my explanation yet, but I will keep working on it.
Actually, that helps a lot. So it's something you notice over a whole year. It's not like something I can go out and see
correct
tonight.
Right. The stars appear to go in a little circle of 41 seconds of arc. Let's talk about Einstein's postulates a little bit and jump into some of this relativity stuff. Einstein is an amazing figure. Many would say he's the greatest physicist of all time. Others might give that honor to Newton. They both could lay claim to it in some way. Their contributions are vast in each case. But Einstein really did a miracle in 1905 when he published all those papers in widely varying subfields of physics, got the Nobel Prize for the photoelectric effect, talked about Brownian motion also, and then on the side published this paper on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. We wish, or at least logically, it would make sense that he had been pushed to this by consideration of the Michelson-Morley experiment, which showed that the space was not permeated with this luminiferous ether. It would make sense that someone would say, no ether. Well, then that means that light has to travel in the same speed in all directions, and it would be the same to all observers, and that would be a logical, historical leaping-off place to come up with relativity. But as I mentioned last time, we're not even sure if Einstein had heard of the Michelson-Morley experiment or if it played any role in his development of the special theory of relativity. There's a little bit of controversy on that. I've kind of heard a little bit both ways, but the evidence is very sketchy and we really don't have a good consensus answer. So, what was his thought process? Well, he liked to ask questions when he was even a wee tyke, like, what would it look like if you traveled on a light beam? If you rode one, what would you see? What if a mirror were moving away from you at the speed of light? What would you see in the mirror? And stuff like that. And he'd ask questions like that all the time. Now, we also talked a little bit last time. Where did we talk about that? Somewhere about the fact that Newton's laws were not invariant under certain transformations, and Maxwell's equations weren't invariant under the Galilean transformations. It's almost as if Einstein has been presented with a choice. Einstein, you can stick with Newton's laws, which we know and love, and which make wonderful predictions and help us build bridges and buildings, and they're so wonderful. They are Galilean invariant, which means that they transform. If you have moving reference frames, then you can simply add the velocities, as you would expect to. It's the common sense Galilean transformation. But the other pillar of classical physics is the Maxwell's equations of electricity and magnetism, and they don't transform that way. They don't follow the Galilean laws of transformation. And so they can't both be right, because either Galilean transformations work or they don't. And in one case, you get to keep Newton's laws, and in the other case, you might get to keep Maxwell's equations, but not both. So the two pillars that all classical physics is built on are at odds with each other, and you're going to have to give up one. And it might sound strange to pick Maxwell's equations as the one to keep, and Newton's laws, which we've known for 300 years, as the ones to toss out. That sounds like a interesting choice. Why would Einstein make that choice? Because Maxwell's equations have embedded in them a certain number. Let me see if I can find this, because it's really fairly important. Well, there's the Galilean transformation equations on page 21. But if I go clear back to page five, if you'll look in equation 1.6, maybe I ought to put this on the screen. In equation 1.6, you see this term right here. Even if you haven't been through second semester physics or haven't done it recently and don't remember all the details of these equations, this part right here is the part we want to focus on right now. That part is really interesting, because if you take the product of mu naught and epsilon naught, multiply those two together, invert that, and take the square root of that. In fact, why don't we do that? Do we have a mu naught? We do. Take your calculator out. This is kind of a fun little exercise.
I'm not sure.
Take your calculator out and open the inside cover of your book. This is in the front cover, inside of your book. And just multiply those two numbers together, and then invert it, and then you got a multiplied, inverted, and then square root. Marty Lynn got the right answer. Jacob?
Same.
Miles?
Yep.
Teresa?
Yep.
Deb?
Not yet, I'm sorry.
We'll give you another few seconds, because this is a kind of an interesting exercise.
Probably more interesting if I knew what they were.
In Maxwell's equations is embedded this special value. By the way, I don't know if your calculators can carry through units or not. My HP can do that. If you plug in mu naught and epsilon naught with their respective units, so that it's a dimensioned quantity, then after you do all that, 1 over square root, you end up with a speed. It actually comes out in meters per second. So you should all, Deb's almost there. She's punching her last button right now. She's going to get the speed of light just like everybody else did. The moral of the story is that Maxwell's equations have the speed of light built into them. Well, A, that's interesting and intriguing and very clever, but what's the problem? Well, B, do we believe that the laws of physics ought to be the same whether you are at rest or in a smoothly moving train car with no windows and no doors and no clickety-clack rails? That is to say, in an inertial reference frame moving at a constant velocity, shouldn't the laws of physics be the same? And if they are, then Maxwell's equations should be among those laws. And if Maxwell's equations are true in all inertial reference frames, does everybody know what I mean by inertial reference frame? No acceleration. If the laws of physics, including Maxwell's equations, are equally true in all inertial reference frames, then that means that that equation is true in all inertial reference frames. Or, in other words, that number keeps popping out. That speed, somehow it's a special speed, that speed of light must be the same for all inertial reference frames. That's where Einstein really started thinking about this and came up with his postulates. Now, Galileo before him, and Newton also, had said, yeah, we want to believe in some sort of relativity. We want the laws of physics to be the same for various observers. And so under the Galilean transformation laws, which you see on page 21, you know, Newton's laws transform okay and everything's all right, but Maxwell's equations don't. And so what kind of transformation laws would allow Maxwell's equations to take on the same form or look the same, whether you're moving or whether you're at rest? And that requires that we give up the Galilean transformation laws, and that also kind of then means that we are, so to speak, slightly abandoning Newton's laws of mechanics, and we're going to have to go to the Lorentz transformations, which are somewhere. I don't remember. Oh, there they are on the bottom of page 29. Maxwell's equations transform properly with these transformation equations, which is to say that if you have a moving observer and you compute the relative velocity and all the stuff you're supposed to compute using these equations and other ones that you'll find, there's velocity transformation equations too someplace later on in the chapter, that you will still have that same constant, the mu naught epsilon naught square root 1 over all that. You'll still have the speed of light. So that's where Einstein came at it from. He said, okay, we're going to come up with the two postulates, same one that Galileo had, only this time we're going to make it work, namely that the laws of physics are the same for everybody. There's no privileged reference frame. It's not true for somebody and then not, and then false for somebody else, moving with respect to the first person. The laws of physics have to work for everybody. And if you're in a moving train with no windows or doors and no clickety-clack rails, it's really smooth, you should be able to perform any experiment you want in there and technically not even be able to tell that you are moving. You shouldn't be even know that you're moving. You shouldn't be able to say, oh, I'm so surprised that the laws of physics work when I'm moving, because you shouldn't even know that you're moving. If you peep through the little non-existent window and look outside, you could equally well say, oh, everything else is whizzing past me and I'm perfectly at rest. The laws of physics will work that good in any reference frame. That's the first postulate. But to make it work, he also has to come up with his second. Or in other words, the second is kind of a corollary to the first one. You can't really have the full-blown first postulate if you don't have the second one, because Maxwell's equations would be violated. Maxwell's equations say the speed of light has to be the same for all observers, and that's part of the laws of physics. So kind of to emphasize it, we list it as a second postulate, but it's kind of included in the first one. And that is that no matter how fast you're going, you will measure the speed of light to be that same number, 3.0 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. Everybody measures it the same way. Lots of experiments you can do to measure the speed of light. No matter which one you do on the roadside, no matter which one you do in the train, you'll both come up with the same number. Now, this brings us back to our interesting dilemma from last time. That is, if you're moving with respect to each other, we'll have Henry and Albert in the video here in a minute, right when they're adjacent to each other, they're at the same place at the same time, for an instant, as they move past. Then if a light flash occurs, the light spreads out in spherical wavefronts in all directions, and it spreads out from that point, then each observer believes they're at the center of this expanding sphere. But they're not in the same place anymore after that. I mean, only at that instant are in the same place. They're moving with respect to each other, so they continue to move, and they both continue to believe that they're at the same, at the center of the same expanding light sphere. That's bizarre. It's really weird. That's our first, you know, wake-up call that this is going to be strange stuff. How can you resolve this? Einstein carefully laid this out and says, well, I like Maxwell's equations, so therefore I like the speed of light. It's got to be the same for everybody. If the laws of physics are the same for everybody, then if the speed of light's the same for all observers, that's why they both think they're at the same center, or the center of the same sphere. Albert and Henry both think the light is going out away from that spot at 3 times 10 to the 8th meters per second. And they were there when it happened. But neither one of them can say they're absolutely at rest or absolutely moving. All they know is that there's a relative motion. So they could either one of them think they're at rest, and so that sphere ought to expand around them. But how can they both say that? Einstein thought about this for a long, long time and came up with a radical solution to this issue. he's really on good footing so far, but you come up against this and you say, can this be resolved? Maybe physics isn't even true. Maybe we should just throw up our hands and go home. But he thought about it so long, and he finally realized the only way to resolve this dilemma, to have both of them be at the center of this expanding light sphere, is to have space be affected by the motion. That is to say that the Euclidean space that is out there forever and is in orthogonal coordinate systems and has little tick marks along the axes and sits there forever, you know, you have an X and a Y and a Z, three dimensions of space, and it goes on forever, infinitely in all directions, and it's perfectly orthogonal. We like this Euclidean coordinate system. That can't be right. Now, I don't know how many of us would be creative enough and original enough to be willing to give up our conception of space just to solve a little problem about Maxwell's equations and the speed of light. But it's the only way to do it. And Einstein kept at it and was willing to, you know, he was enough of a iconoclast, enough of a liberal free thinker to even entertain the possibility of altering space. Space isn't the same. In fact, he realized that you can't just talk about X, Y, Z anymore. It's a four-dimensional deal, and it looks different from different perspectives. The fourth dimension, of course, in this case is time, X, Y, Z, and T, and it's now not just space, but it's space-time. And looking at it that way is the only way this stuff can make any sense. What are some of the weird things that pop up out of this? Well, really weird stuff. Moving things look shorter. Moving things have their clocks go slower. Maybe most startling of all, right out of the chute, is events that are simultaneous in one reference frame are not necessarily simultaneous in a different reference frame. Or I could even be more forceful about that and say, will not be simultaneous in any other reference frame moving with respect to the first one. Simultaneity is not preserved. So just because Miles says firecracker A and firecracker B blew up at the same time, that wouldn't be true for someone that's moving with respect to Miles. They wouldn't explode at the same time. Think four dimensions. Think looking at it from different views, different angles in four dimensions. That's the kind of weird stuff we're going to have to encounter. Now, that was kind of an introduction. I wanted to get that much out so you kind of know what to look for. But frankly, the way to see this and get a conceptual understanding that actually really helps you understand this, I cannot do this any better than the graphics in the mechanical universe. The 3D rotating animated graphics are the best way I've ever seen to display this concept. I could draw stuff on the board back here. I could, you know, I can explain till I'm blue in the face, but to conceptualize and see this, I really like these videos. So we're going to watch a couple of episodes from this in the next 2 days, today and tomorrow, from the Mechanical Universe series. If you'd like to review them, they're available for free online video streaming, video on demand from the website, and you can watch them again if you want to. But I'd kind of like to start and stop and discuss and watch as we go through these. So if you'll switch to the DVD.
Mechanical Universe, that we watched for the physics class for his credit for them.
Okay. Yep. We want the Lorentz transformation.
I just want to think about it a while. I wish we could see those charts again. That was neat.
You will be able to. I can send you over email. Is everybody subscribed to the LS Green class mailing list, by the way? I hope. I will send you the URL so that you can watch those on your computer. These Mechanical Universe are available for video on demand over the internet, so you can watch these again. And I would recommend it. It takes a few times to really understand the importance of what it's trying to tell you. They're very, very clever, very well done. Haven't seen any presentation of relativity that does it this well, so I keep showing these over and over, but it might take a couple of times through them.
I was just going to make a comment when they go through, because I got so caught up in the math in the book, you know, trying to tell everything mathematically. It's so abstract, and then conceptualization of the movies, it makes all the math, it makes so much more sense.
Yeah, and I hope you're not intimidated by this math. It's basically just algebra. It's not heavy-duty differential equations in this chapter. It's pretty straightforward math, but getting a conceptualization of what this is really trying to tell you about the physical world is what I hope the graphics accomplish. Anybody else have any questions? There are sections in the book on each of these topics, time dilation and length contraction, and so anyway, we want to see this guy, pretty famous physicist. He's the narrator through this whole series. You grow to quite like him. But anyway, he has a funny little notational habit that some other physicists do, but it's not, I think it's less and less common. That little squiggly underneath the letters is his method of indicating vectors. Work with other students on the homework and not try to do it yourself. Of course, this will be a order of magnitude more difficult for Deb and Teresa, but whatever efforts can be made, use the LS Green mailing list or various people's cell phone numbers or whatever, call me in my office, but I would like you to not feel like you're trying to do this alone. Make this a group effort. It's easy possible for you all to get A's in this class. It's not competitive. You don't have to have someone else do poor so you can do well. Cooperation is the name of the game. Try to help everybody else learn the material, and we'll be in good shape. We'll just start over from here. I'm going to go back to my office and see what's wrong with the web page and find you some more information on stellar aberration and give you the URL for these videos on demand, and I'll see you tomorrow.